Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello. Welcome along to this week's episode of Let's Get Running Podcast. It's me, the host, Sean. I'm again on my own this week. It's the bank holiday weekend. It's sunny outside. I'm going to be quick because I've got to get back out there and enjoy the sun. With my wife, looking forward to that. Just come off the back of a big run. My legs pretty tired. So, I'm going to be vegging out the rest of the afternoon. We've got a great show for you today. As always, if you do like the show, by the way, please review, share, anything else that helps us spread the word about the show. Always helpful for us. But actually, we're starting a bit of a series now for the next month. It's about kind of the races of your life. So, we're talking to Tom Gale. Tom's an athlete. He's also a broadcaster. So he's worked with a number of different, groups from like Athleticos. So, we'll talk a bit about that on the show. He's now working for the BBC on Radio 5 Live. We'll talk a bit about his broadcasting career, his athletics career. And we're going to talk about three races that have kind of shaped his running life. So we're talking about the race that got him hooked, the race of his life, the best race he ever ran, and finally the greatest race he ever saw. And actually, we'd like you guys to get involved. So if you want to tell us, either on the means of social media, I'm certainly putting mine up on Instagram this week, my favorite three races, photos of those three races. We want to hear that. It's a kind of a good thing to share. We're looking forward to hearing your stories. If you don't want to share that on social media, please just get in touch at letsgetrunning.co.uk. We'll try and read a few out on the show. And that'd be great. So enjoy the show. Here's Tom. He's going to chat about his selections and see you next week. So on today's show, we are talking with Tom Gale. How are you doing, Tom?
I'm very well, Sean. How about your good self, mate?
I'm very good. I'm looking out the window. It's sunny out there. I haven't been for my run today, so I'm looking forward to getting out there and getting amongst it a bit later on. But hey, how's life for you? Whereabouts are you based?
So I'm in the glorious surroundings of Stoke-on-Trent. I have done my run, albeit of 15 minutes, and I'm not sure if this is something we'll get into, mate, but you know, you'll relate the challenges of becoming a parent and realising that those personal bests are all behind me. You know, yeah. The big difference now is obviously the game changer with regards to lockdown is you can exercise as much. Basically, I'm on pretty much full-time daddy daycare at the moment, so it used to be you can go out once a day. And obviously, I'd take the two boys with me, and I thought I can't be quite selfish to, you know, go for a run, and then they don't get out and exercise, sort of thing. So until the rules changed, it was just us walking around fields for an hour and a half, 2 hours. But now, obviously, you can get out a bit more. I can be a bit more selfish and go for a little run and do the walk later. But obviously, the fitness is very questionable at the moment, mate.
Yeah, yeah. So there's no eye on a return to competitive athletics now.
Certainly not the ship has sailed. I think it's one of those, mate. It's all in context and perspective. You know, I had my days of, you know, this was the best shape of my life. I could throw everything into it. Priorities change, mate. But there's still that competitive drive. And I always, you know, I keep threatening our local club, City of Stoke AC, that the Veterans Summer Track League, that I'll make an appearance one day. And, you know, I was planning to do that this summer, but obviously, you know, things get in the way. So it's been postponed till 2021. But it's one of those, if I don't do it, I'm not going to be sitting there thinking, oh my God, I wish I got back to it. But yeah, it's a sport I loved, you know, it's my number one sport. I'd love to be in an opportunity to get back and toe that start line to some degree, but we'll just take it as it comes, mate.
Perfect. And so we'll talk a bit about your running and your athletics career, let's say, a bit later on. But at the moment, listeners to this, the podcast, might recognise your voice from Radio 5 Live. So you commentate on there.
That's right.
Until the lockdown.
Yeah, until also maybe occasionally reading the sports news at the moment, if what limited sports news there is. Yeah, so I was a teacher for a very long time. And I think pretty much largely the spur to switch employment, mate, was off the back of the 2012 Olympics. Obviously, you know, the legacy effects, you know, it's not just about inspiring the next generation of medal winners. That was a real kick in the butt to me to think, wow, you know, could you imagine doing that as a career, being at these events, which I had experienced to some degree, you know, voluntarily doing a bit of reporting and things like that. But I think that was what coincided with my wife wanting to relocate and stuff. That was like, right, if I want to make this sort of media career happen, I'm going to go for it. So I went supply teaching, and to cut a long story short, you know, balancing various bits. And then I've got significant breaks over the last few years that, yeah, so pretty much now I am largely most renowned for football reporting. So on, as you've mentioned, BBC Radio 5 Live, and occasionally on the TV, Final Score, being a number of games throughout the country, which obviously is not happening for the foreseeable, but that was my, that's my bread and butter, I would say, at the moment.
And have you got much of a look in at sort of athletics on the BBC? Have you had many options to do stuff like that?
Yeah, so I suppose if we go back, basically, when I was an athlete, I launched a website called Athleticos, which was later succeeded by Vinco Sport. But I was sort of one of the first that it was basically I got injured, and I was like, what am I going to do with all this spare time? And Flowtrack was just, I think that was literally, it was probably a couple of years old, and I saw all these guys just pure running geeks, which I'm a self-confessed running geek. I have no shame in saying that. You know, I used to study the results, know all the names, you know, I was just, and these guys were going to like big meets in America and interviewing all these superstars. And I was a bit like, well, you know, there's nothing like that in England. You know, the BBC does, it's a great stalwart for athletics, but the lowest common denominator is the British champs, isn't it? So, you know, the likes of your BMCs, you know, any of those sort of things, those weren't recorded sort of things. So that's how I got into it. And then I progressed quite quickly. I actually did do a bit for Eurosport as well. I was very fortunate to work along Tim Hutchings, who I know you've spoken to on this podcast. But as you go on to the athletics of the BBC, the radio commentator is Mike Costello, and he is fantastic. I'm never going to sort of nudge him out the way. And TV, you know, Steve Cram, Andrew Cotter, you know, it's a very established thing. And I think that's obviously potentially why football is more my, you know, my go-to at the moment, is because it's largely probably the most competitive, but there's many more opportunities. As we talked about, if we were looking back on this year, maybe, you know, as it would have played out on TV, there would have been the British champs, the Diamond League, and then the Olympics sort of thing. So there's not much room to maybe give new people a chance. And also, I'm always one of those when, if you've got Steve Cram behind the microphone, you know, why are you going to look anywhere else? You know, it's one of those, isn't it? Sometimes you just have to accept that the people there, you know, I'm not giving up on it, but this whole whatever career you're in, I'm sure many people can relate. It's about moving plates, isn't it? And opportunities. And I guess really I'm always primed for, should such a thing happen as someone gives me a call and says, Tom, we need you for this sort of thing, I'd jump at it. But at the moment, rather than sitting there and waiting for the one opportunity that's most unlikely, I'm just trying to get out there and do as much as I can, mate.
And it is a shame that, like you said, there's only two or three events published, shown on live TV. I can't remember, even during my days of competing, there was Sky Sports would show the cross-country challenge and stuff, and there'd be a little bit of this and a little bit of that on TV. It's a shame that it's, you know, despite people like yourself who want to try and put these stories and these live events to the masses, it's not really taken off. Is that a problem, do you think, for us? Do you think it's something we can work on and think we can address, or was it just the way we are in niche sport and we're not going to get viewing figures that demand that they show the action?
Yeah, well, I think streaming's, this was one of the things I got, it caused me a lot of stress at the time, but Athleticos, it was that general progression towards people wanting things live. And, you know, when I was talking about this, you know, what, a decade ago, you know, internet connections weren't as reliable as they are now sort of thing. But now, pretty much, you could go to an event and stream it off your phone, couldn't you, sort of thing. And that's sometimes what we're a little bit guilty of in our sport. People just want to see it. They're not necessarily too bothered about the quality of it. And I think that's always going to be the challenge, that established media broadcasters, they're always going to want to do it well. And the unfortunate circumstance athletics finds itself is a lot of big sponsors and companies, you know, they're just looking at athletics and they're not seeing it as a moneymaker, mate, in terms of what they can outlay. Because you mentioned all the events. I remember the Loughborough International. He still historically is a fantastic event. That used to be on primetime television, do you know what I mean? And I'm sure the figures would have justified it. As you've mentioned, Sky have obviously dipped there too into athletics. Eurosport have been a great supporter, and as mentioned, the BBC. But even now, the BBC, they're constantly facing a lot of criticism because, and obviously I do have a bit of an inside track on this, that a lot of the time they can't justify taking up, say, for example, the whole of a Saturday afternoon because the numbers are not there. And a lot of people, they don't like the entertainment package, the way the sport's brought together. You know, the whole match of the day, you know, it's built around action and pundits, isn't it? And you throw a pundit in on athletics and everyone's always moaning, aren't they? Because, and I know match of the day is perhaps a bad example because it's a retrospective. The action's all happened and they're showing you the best bit of it. But again, one of the common criticisms of athletic coverage is when you go to a pundit and they're like, well, why are we not showing the discus or the long jump or lap seven of the 5 or 10K sort of thing, isn't it? So obviously Seb's come in, hasn't he? He's tried to rebrand it. Street Athletics, I think, is fascinating. I've worked and spectated on both of those. But I wouldn't say I'm worried about it because, you know, every 4 years at the very least, the only sport people are going to be talking about at an Olympic Games primarily is always going to be track and field. And we always are going to survive off that. It's just because, you know, the allure potentially now of a professional career and how much you can generate from it is obviously dramatically reducing year by year because, you know, like I say, people are just not tuning in their masses to watch athletics, unfortunately.
Yeah, and it means we're not going to get the best athletes, you know, in our sport, really, I guess. But just if you can make, you know, League One, League Two, you can make far in advance of what you'd make as a professional athlete in most occasions, then you're more likely to go into... So the top athletes are going to go into different sports where they can actually make some cash. But I guess that's just the way of the world, isn't it? I think
I think, unfortunately, that's the thing. I think it can be better, but it's going to take someone who is just extremely passionate and have an absolute load of money. Again, if you think of the Premier League and stuff like that now, obviously foreign ownership is the big thing. There's that many people who are just seeing that product and thinking, throw this money at it, I'll make a loss maybe short term, but the worldwide global appeal of it outweighs that. I don't see many people looking at athletics and seeing it as a sport that they could revolutionise and make a profit from, unfortunately. That's the brutal... that's a very blinded media perspective, isn't it, though? But equally so, you know, as we've mentioned now, the things of Highgate, you know, that's readily streamed every year. You know, Vinco Sport is still doing a great job supporting grassroots. The BBC, they're embracing this whole red button thing, aren't they? So this is across sports where pretty much all the national governing bodies now, aren't they? If they can set themselves up a live stream, the BBC are giving people that platform to say, if it's rugby league, you're swimming, you're equestrian or whatever, you give us a stream and we'll put it on that. And that's obviously the future, isn't it? But again, if we're talking about what ultimately NGBs want is revenue to help build the sport bigger and better, then there's no return for that other than to say the platform, isn't it? You use the BBC platform, it goes to millions, but we're not actually going to give you direct money to put this on the BBC Sport website.
Yeah, it's interesting that you're the first person that I've spoke to who's, you mentioned a few minutes ago about the fact that, you know, Match of the Day has pundits and it's discussing the action, and I myself complain as soon as they leave watching the 5K race and we leave the action, I'm on Twitter shouting, sort of saying, you know, why watching the pop up? Put it, forget listening to Denise Lewis. Let's put that there.
Yeah. Well, I suppose it's the thing with football is it's that that one bit of action that's going on for that one time, isn't it? You don't need to look anywhere else, do you? Because obviously the beauty of athletics is there's so much going on, isn't there? And you know, logistically as well, it'd be foolish to have a timetable where it was literally one event going on per time, wasn't it, sort of thing? And again, obviously a lot of it's, I suppose, the BBC coverage, say, for example, take the Saturday, for example, it's built around that men's 100 metres, isn't it? Because they know everyone largely wants to watch that final, isn't it? So if you've only got an hour and a half of airspace and you've got your Colin Jackson, you've got your Denise Lewis, your Michael Johnson per se to get in and, you know, to justify having them in the audience that they're going to bring it in. It's always going to be like that, isn't it? But then the purists like ourselves, we want to see that 5K play out. And equally your field eventers, they want to see every single, you know, there's obviously this whole long jump thing of cutting down the time, isn't it? You know, a lot of, like, Greg Rutherford's been very vocal about that, the way they're trying to package that for TV and entertainment. There's always going to be those purists that just like, this is not the sport I know and love, that, you know, part of why I'm obsessed with it is seeing every single second of it play out. But take your standalone sport fan who just likes a bit of athletics. You want to see how, if someone runs under 10 seconds and have a bit of a laugh and get informed for an hour and a half and zone out, don't you? That's unfortunately the world that we're living in terms of consuming sport. And it's not just athletics alone. That this is the thing. I always champion athletics, that we're lucky that we get whatever. You know, we shouldn't be grateful. There's always argument to say we should be getting more. But if you think of a lot of the other non-major sports, and like, when did you see live basketball on British TV? Do you know what I mean? So what are those fans sitting there thinking? Whereas we have been a bit too blessed. And I think that's the thing. We used to have so much, and every year we are seeing it chipped away, isn't it? And I can completely understand people's frustrations with that.
Yeah. Well, let's move on and chat about your career. We're starting a bit of a feature where we're looking at kind of almost like race of your life. So you've seen these various things again, sort of footballers doing a similar thing in lockdown, looking at kind of almost races that have shaped you and your life, and sort of discussing them and what effect they had on you. So yeah. I've kind of selected three different races, or given you the option to select three different races rather, that made an impact on you. So the first thing I want to talk about is the race that got you hooked in athletics. So that can be either a race you were in that you just were so enthused by that you thought, right, I've got more, get more of this, I've got to, you know, pick up my training, whatever else, or a race you watched and then you were inspired to take part in the sport. Do you have one singular race you can pin that down to?
Yeah, mate, I'd go with the former, which was, you know, the race that literally got you and just made you realise that this was I love this and I want to see how far I can take it. So I was 15 years old at the time, and I've been one of those. I'd loved sport all my life. Football was all, you know, certainly as a primary school kid kicking bottle tops around the yard, it was all about you want to be the best footballer sort of thing. And then, but equally, I was very fortunate to go to a sports college. So the range of sports I played at that time was so diverse, from obviously football was the mainstay, but I used to swim, I used to do badminton. Obviously, I had a good engine, so I was doing the sort of endurance running. But up until that point, I'd sort of just played around with athletics. I was one of those where I loved the camaraderie of going up to the club, but I was probably what many people hated in terms of, like, I have vivid memories of doing like distance sessions and it'd be foggy and we'd like cut across the track and not run the whole way around, you know, because it was like, this is too hard, man. I'm an 800 meter guy. Give me my two laps, miles on the track or whatever. I was like, nah. And I can't remember the specific trigger, but it was something that happened that winter. It probably largely coincided that I knew, well, football people probably knew long time before, I was never going to make it as a footballer. But there was clearly something that was a bit like, well, football's not going to happen. What am I next best at? And, you know, I'd had some degree, I'd represented the county and stuff like that. Where I'd say I wasn't someone who wasn't training, but I definitely wasn't training seriously. And I do remember vividly just having this run. I used to run like 25 minutes. And for me, that was a big thing. Like, you know, before that, I'd probably run in 10, 15 minutes at most. But I was maybe doing that about two, three times a week, as well as all the other sport I was doing, as doing interval sessions. And I'd made the conscious effort. Me and my coach had talked about, you know, I want to step up to the 1500 meters. So I know this is very long-winded, but basically the first track race of the season, the McDonald's League, you know, I had so many great memories of that. And it was the 1500, and basically coming into this, I'd been largely an 800 meter runner. As an under 17, my personal best was 4:31 for 1500 meters, which is absolutely shocking. But I was like, right, I want to go to the English schools. I've got to run 4:08 or whatever. I don't think I'm quick enough to do it over 800 meters, which was 1:59 or whatever. I'm going to give it all. And the first race, basically, it was down in Cardiff. It was what it just epitomised to me, you know, as you get a bit older, I don't know if you can relate to this, you turn up to races, sometimes you're like, oh, it's a bit windy today, or who's in that, you know, maybe not feel, but I just remember that race, I was just like, I'm just going to go for this. And probably splits-wise, it was one of those where you got gradually slower, but I remember I just had a right ding-dong with this Richard Kinney, I'm pretty sure his name was, he was from a young lad from Cardiff AC, and we had a right good race, and I ran 4:14. Which again was nothing standout, but I'd ran 4:30. That's what I mean, you know. And I'd won the race, you know. So arguably, I still had a bit to give, sort of thing. And I just remember and it was one of those where I think I'd taken a lap, he'd taken a lap, and that would, you know, that's the thing of endurance, isn't it? You know, pushing yourself against someone. We'd had a right ding dong, And then maybe in the last 150 metres, I can't remember it explicitly, I remember accelerating past him, coming over, taking the win. Obviously, maximum points for the team was a big thing as well, sort of thing. And I was just like, right, you know, this is legit. And obviously, subsequent performances did suggest that. But I remember that was definitely the turning point for me, that I fully identified myself from that point forward as a distance runner, because I even got, you know, I played football to a reasonable level. And I remember there was a couple of cup finals that summer, and I was just like, sorry, I'm not available because I've got this race, sort of thing, which, you know, like I say, was just, to me, that then just set me on the road for whatever has followed. It was, I just vividly just remember just thinking, yeah, I can do something with this. And, you know, ultimately it was probably like I could go to the Olympics or whatever, but from that point forward, I was Tom Gale, the distance runner, I guess.
Yeah, and was it the win? What was it specifically that made you so enthused by that? Was it, or just the fact that you were able to go so deep and sort of bring that performance out of your body?
I think it was probably a lot of things that, you know, I think, like I said, I'd had a good relationship with my coach, and we talked about making this step up. As we talked about the huge chunk off your personal best. And I think that's the thing. Sometimes, obviously, with an 800-meter race, and I know that's as far from your specialist distance, mate, there's obviously, it's a lot shorter time, and the glamour of the 1,500 meters. Everyone wants to be good at 1,500 meters, don't you know? It's that perfect medium, the four, you know, just shy of four laps. And you know, John Mayock was one of my huge heroes growing up. He wasn't born locally, but he ran for Cannock and Stafford. So, you know, every time I'd see him on telly and stuff, I'd just be like, oh, I just want to be just like John Mayock. And again, that was probably just an opportunity to just sit there when I got some sort of feedback to suggest, yeah, you know, this is, you can do well at this sort of, because that's always been with me, that I've always wanted to do well at things. You know, now it's not the case. I want to, you know, just do things for enjoyment. But like a lot of youngsters out there, you want to be good at something, don't you? And, you know, and like I say, I was sort of that thing of, you know, sometimes the most popular kids at school were the athletes, weren't they, sort of thing. And for me, it wasn't, for football, it was like, right, now this is something I can stand alone. And obviously, as you get old, you know, as you progress up a level, the spotlight wasn't so much upon you. But I vividly remember like being, you know, at that time saying you were one of the best in your county and the Midlands, sort of thing. I think that year I came maybe fifth or sixth in the Midland Championships or something, you know. And then that just, again, just further reinforced that I wasn't someone who was just messing about at this. I could actually, you know, through plenty of hard work, give it a real go and see how far I could take it, I guess.
And it's a shame that we kind of lose as you go through the ranks. That thing, fifth in the Midlands, is so inspiring. All these kids in the Midlands at school, and I'm the fifth best of all these kids. When you get to, you go through the years and you get to your 30s and you've been doing it a while. So when you've been doing it a while, you're probably still competitive and at the upper end of things. And, you know, doesn't really feel the same again, does it? The fifth in the middle, oh, right, you know, last year I was fourth or whatever. It loses its luster a bit. That initial enthusiasm, you can't really beat it, I don't think.
No, definitely. And I think that sort of time, you're under 15, under 17, obviously people get, the standard rises as you get to juniors under 23s, but the depth falls off a cliff, isn't it? So that's in, you know, you do get those classic kids who literally do athletics in PE and so all of a sudden they're English schools finalists, aren't they, sort of thing. So the range of talent that you're competing against at that age is so competitive, because like I say, maybe his fifth in the seniors at the Midlands wasn't such a big deal. It'd be like, oh, you know, but as an under 17, I remember, you know, the names I was sort of competing against, like Phil Nichols, Tom Holden, Simon Stigall, James Hogg, you know, to me, these guys were all people who made English schools and English schools finalists. So to, like you say, to put yourself, and that's what I love about athletics, is you always get that sort of definitive marker, don't you? It's one of those where if you're an under 17, if you're under 15, under 17 footballer, where do you know where you fit in terms of being the best midfielder or the best striker or the best goalkeeper? Yes, people get selected for England, but obviously the beauty of things with athletics is always that accountability with the stopwatch and ultimately your position, isn't it, sort of thing. And being able to like regularly win stuff, do you know what I mean? And that's something I definitely, you know, as you talked about, as you get older, your sort of appreciation of winning, sort of sometimes you accept maybe not winning and still, but that's the thing again, so many years in that under 17 and junior career that you'd be winning races, and sometimes didn't you take that for granted, don't you? You sort of get it hard into your senior career and you're like, God, what could I do to win a race? Do you know what I mean? Sort of thing. And, you know, again, that was being able to cross the line and not being funny, see your mum and dad and sometimes when my grandparents, you know, he did. That's it. I'm always one of those. Sometimes I'm maybe taking it a bit heavier that when people come to support you, I want to deliver and stuff like that. And obviously that in turn maybe brings a lot of pressure, but partly that's why we do it, isn't it? You know, you put yourself and get yourself worked up, but when it happens and it comes off and, you know, my gran was there giving you a big hug afterwards, you just felt on top of the world, mate. So
yeah, it was always the thing that you hated that 25 minutes before the race when your lungs are in your throat and you just think, I just don't want to do this. And then look back an hour later and it was just, you realize how amazing that hour was and how much fun, how much the adrenaline was really giving you that boost. But anyway, we should move on to our next race. And so obviously you improved as a junior, you went to the English schools, you competed throughout your 20s. You say you were competitive 1500 meter, and did you do a lot of cross country? Was that kind of your bag, or was it
I think again that it was one of those where it's certainly early on in my career, it was one of those where you, like many I'm sure, cross country was a case of setting off at a ridiculous speed and gradually getting slower and slower as you sort of worked your way around. Mick Woods, I went to Brunel University, and again, that my career is in little etches of, I was very fortunate, arguably, that I was never overtrained as a kid. So in terms of my running career, there was always something I could add. But I started hooking up with Mick Woods around about, I think I was about 20. And not to say I was a bad cross-country runner then, but we were doing such big sessions that I finally started to get the grasp and was able to go through, you know, stages in a cross-country race. You know, again, I was a bit weak, do you know what I mean, mate? Like 1500 was my bag, 800 was my bag. I could tolerate that. When you're talking 20 minutes plus 25, and obviously a senior, arguably half an hour, 40 minutes of just like going through points where you're feeling terrible, but then equally so, points like when you're 8 or 9K in and thinking, God, I've got another gear here, sort of thing, you know. So that was, you know, cross country was something I learned to grow and love. Definitely early on, it was the lesser evil of get through the cross country season. It helps you track. Whereas, you know, as you got older and more mature, I definitely really attacked the cross-country season and respectively had targets. It was never to win stuff by and large sort of thing. But yeah, it was a huge learning curve. And that's probably what I'd missed the most at times now, is that opportunity to say that this race is going to be 35, 40 minutes or whatever. I can just chill out and enjoy this, work my way through, pick off some bodies and just have a good time pushing myself.
Yeah, and so what then was through your career? What was the greatest race of your career? What was the race of your life?
The race of my life is still my 1500 meter personal best, which is never going to get any better. I'm just, you know, 3:47.9. But again, it's a bit more of the story to it. So I'm trying to think. So basically, I'd been injured for roughly around about 2 years, I think. So I'd had a real breakthrough. I'd run 151 and 3:48. And, you know, all distance runners do this thing where, you know, next year I can get down to 3:45 or I can go under 1:49. But basically, the long-term prognosis, I think it was, I had undiagnosed Osgood-Schlatter's, which is basically your bones too big for your skeletal system, your skin and stuff. So that eventually caught up with me. And I went through so much physio and so much, you know, so many different people, the NHS eventually doing like, you know, MRI scans, and I just couldn't sort this knee. But I met a great lady called Paula Wilde, who unfortunately passed away. I can't recall her, but basically she was the one who was that lady who saved my career. She was absolutely brilliant because she was just like, I went into it. It was one of those where you do a range of strengthening exercises, don't you? And she was just warts and all. She was just like, that's pathetic. The reason why you've got all these issues is, you know, the classic of this back muscle to that glute, to that hamstring, to your knee, it's all, there's an imbalance sort of thing. But she just got me on this road to recovery, which I thought, for by and large, that I'd never get back from. I was always really going to give it a go, but I was never getting any signs of encouragement that I'd actually start running again. So eventually I obviously got back running, and I think by the time then I was sort of 27, 28. So I wouldn't say I'd missed the prime years of my life, but sort of 24, 25, you know, it was a long time away from racing. But basically, to cut a long story short, and one of my big things was always, I need to make the senior 3As. And the qualifying time was 3:48 exactly. So the last opportunity, I think I'd ran, I'd ran 3:50, I'd ran 3:49, and this was pretty much the last opportunity. Thankfully, it was at the Haven that is Watford. All the distance runners will know the BMC. As soon as that Watford Grand Prix comes out, everyone's like, that's the day. That's the day when I smash my personal best or whatever it was like that. And that was one of those. I'd been giving it a go plenty of times. I think in a couple of races, I'd gone out of the 3:48, sort of 61 sort of thing. So I'd done all of that. But this was the day where the pressure was on. You know, it was like this. If I think the cutoff was the next day or that weekend or something like that. And I just remember just, you know, not being too phased. I went through 800 metres in 2 minutes, so a little bit quicker or whatever. I ended up coming second in the race, but went to just, I think that was the thing. It was that, crossed the line, immediately it was like, what time have I run? Do you know, what have I done? And then to look at the official results and just to sneak inside that 3A's time by a tenth of a second, you know, again, it was that, it's all been worth it. I can go and compete now on the national stage. But then also it was just that greater sense of, I always remember Ricky Sousa, who was a contemporary of mine. And, you know, he went to the Olympics, but injuries, unfortunately, were the put him, his career to an end far too early. And he just, I remember having a great conversation with him, probably maybe a year or so afterwards, that he said he really respected me because I just dug in and come out the other side and got better. Obviously, I never got any more better, but it was that thought of going through so many years of injury and by and large, you know, being appreciative that you could get back and just be competitive perhaps would have been enough. But the fact you can get back and put yourself in a position to be the better than you ever been before, that's something that I definitely look back on more and over the years and just think, yeah, what a race, what a day that was.
Yeah. And can you remember much about the accident? Can you remember how you were feeling? Do you remember where you, how kind of the race unfolded at all?
Yeah, I think it was another one of my coaches that I came across was George Gandy. And one of the great things he taught me was, I think by and large, my approach to racing was always about even paced, keep yourself involved, give yourself a chance. But George was always one of those, he sort of built in this self metronome with you. So that was a case of trying to ignore the split sort of thing. So I don't know what I went through in the first lap. I know I went through 800 metres in 2 minutes. So immediately then you're getting that sort of feedback of it's on sort of thing. And then the big thing I remember was hitting the bell in 2:47. So I needed to run like a 60 last lap. And a lot of the time, you know, I'm sure many of us are guilty of it, is you hit that bell and you just go, don't you? You're just like, especially when you know the pressure's on. But one of the big things I learned from George was like that whole finishing, that last 100 metres needs to be your strongest. And that's one of the most vivid things that I can remember is just building. It wasn't, you know, huge gear changes, but every 100 metres, you just take it up a little bit more of a notch, knowing that obviously that first one, well, I still need three more gears here sort of thing. But just like, and obviously it was probably coincided with the, I was mid-pack, so I was passing people as well. So the sort of, you know, that feel that you get that, oh yeah, I must be going well because I'm overtaking people and stuff like that. And again, just crossing that line, knowing you're giving it your all, but it wasn't as though I was like dying on my knees as I was stumbling across the line sort of thing. It was running strong all the way through the line. And like I say, in terms of, you can maybe argue splits tactically, specifically wasn't the even perfect race, but it was one of those where I think I definitely, even though walking away from it, you were hoping for the time, I didn't walk away thinking I should have done this better or done it. It was one of those where I thought, I've given it my all there. Let's see what sort of happens. Because it's those classic ones where you see the time, the winner stopped at 3:45, I think maybe. So you're like counting mentally in your head, but obviously your own judgment of what a second is so skewed or whatever. So you're literally waiting for that classic of someone posting it on the club notice board. And I'm just seeing it. Like I say, it was 3:48 exactly was the time, and I ran 3:47.9. I was just like, "Oh, yeah, that was it." Yeah.
And did you have many people come and watch you? Were you there on your own, or did you have a group of family and stuff there to see that race?
It was one. It's one of those. So my parents were a lot huge supporters for my career, but by that point, I wasn't living away from home. I was running every other, you know, 2-3 times a week sometimes racing wise. So it was largely my girlfriend and my partner at the time. But it's one of those where I was at Loughborough University. So everywhere you go, there was always people you trained with, and you know, we'd always sort of support and cheer for each other, which again, sometimes is like, it could maybe get the better of you, like, oh God, such and such is here watching or whatever. But I think particularly, you know, we all you probably know this, mate, you've been in groups where I took a lot from. People knew your situation and there was a lot of goodwill that you like you say, you hadn't given up, and that was a huge thing as well, that people wanted me to do well, because, you know, it's more the sort of moral of it, that it was someone who thought the career was over and they're giving it a go. And you know, I was never going to be a 3A's medalist or whatever, but I made it abundantly clear that I was going to judge myself on being able to get to the big dance, as I used to call it. The big thing for me, similar to, you know, the collegiate system, you know, in America, it's all about making NCAAs, isn't it? Getting to that, you know, that degree of status. And for me, that was, like I say, to get to potentially be on television and say, here's me at the national final in this, my chosen sport, going against the very best that the country has to offer.
Pretty amazing. And how did it go then? How did the nationals play out?
I think I didn't get progress past the heats. I think I ran about 3:50, and this was the thing, you know, that huge jump I'd made. I ran about 3:50 in the heats, I remember. It was one of those where, I think who the names, it was like Andy Baddeley was, I think he was the form man then. I'm pretty sure he was in my heat at the time as well. And that was the thing. Maybe I wasn't ready for that sort of depth of competition, because obviously, you know, obviously seeded races, you were largely in and around guys who were at the same time of you. Obviously, I was in the field with people who'd ran low 3:40s, even quicker than that, 3:35, 3:36 sort of thing. So I think maybe I got a little bit overawed with it, but again, it wasn't. I didn't run badly, you know. It was one of those where that was just me. And I think if memory recalls me right, I ran 3:50 off going through 800 in like 2:04 or something like that. So it really ramped up for the winners to do their time and stuff. So again, it was like, at the time I was probably gutted, but you know, as you have a bit of a debrief and look back on it and think, you know, that was probably as good. It was about right. You know what I mean?
It wasn't as though
I don't think I had another huge jump in me to, I think you would have had to run about 3:44, 3:43 to make the final or whatever. So, and I wasn't that good, mate. So it wasn't as though, if everyone would have qualified in 3:48, 3:49, you perhaps would have been walking away going, oh yeah, no, but.
Yeah. But you had that experience.
I did. And also another thing, just to say on that one, that weekend as well, we talked about the Midlands and stuff like that. I was always, like I say, as you get older, the opportunities to do well and win stuff vary over the year, you know, the people's attitude to that. But the Midlands Championship was something I'd always supported. It's still my biggest accolade in terms of being Midlands champion. So the day after Watford, I remember speeding away and literally getting in bed for like 9 o'clock, because it was the Midlands champs the next day. We'd always been fortunate for the Midlands that I knew it would be a straight final. There was never the depth to have heats. And I came second in the Midlands behind Tim Dalton, who'd ran 3:43 or something like that. So again, it was that weekend, you know, we talk about a race, but to run a time less than 12 hours later, go and win another medal at the Midland Championships was just, you know, it's those constant reminders that, yeah, this is the reason I do this. This is, you know, those dark nights and those sessions in the winter, this is the reason why I do stuff like that.
And so what happened? Do you miss, I guess you know that time has passed, but do you miss that competitive, that kind of the urge of that, you know, the dark nights, the hard training? Do you miss that elements of that, or have you had that part of you? You compartmentalized that bit,
yeah,
your life.
I definitely, even now, this is great, mate. I just enjoy being able to, know, with a like-minded individual, just reminisce sort of thing. And that's what I do. I still love the sport, and I get so excited with the diamond, you know, every year, whatever, to see what the British scene is like. I think it's all about context of your life. I feel as though at that time of my life, you know, you're young, carefree, I was a young professional, I didn't have anything else that I really wanted to be doing. I wanted to be good at running. I was fortunate to have a relationship. I had a good teaching career at the time, so, you know, I could give it my all, whereas now I sort of have so much respect for, you know, Benjamin Button, James T, as he's still kicking, you know, to think that for a large part of his most successful parts of the career, he was his father as well. You know, me, like, we go through this thing, you know, my kids still, the terrible sleepers. And that was the thing, you know, back then it was like bed for 10 o'clock, nutrition was on point, you know, all these sessions. I feel as though, you know, literally the whole living like the saint sort of thing. Now, if I was to do that, it would impact on not one, you know, my partner's life, but my wife's life, but also my two boys as well. And I feel as though what I can potentially get out of that is not justifying me, you know, as we were discussing before we went on recording, as it goes to the whole lockdown, when it was the point of being able to go out and exercise once, I can't see what I can get out of it that's going to justify me putting that need ahead of other people sort of thing. So as we mentioned, but the boys will grow up and they'll get older and they'll go and have their lives at their own, and you know, and maybe I'll be one of those that makes a resurgence in the V45s, V50s or whatever. But I feel as though I've definitely had my time of it. And then again, that running is so easy to get back involved in, isn't it? You know, you don't need other people. You need a pair of shoes. You get out the door. It's one of those where I'm fortunate that I can always come back to it. I never hit the highs that I've had, but as you touched, that yearn to be competitive and camaraderie as well. We talked about cross country. That was a big thing for me. The way I enjoyed cross country a lot was, you know, I've competed in the Birmingham League, or we'd get to the intercounties, we'd have a good team. I went to Loughborough University, you know, it was about my result in the context of helping others as part of a team sort of thing as well. So that was a big thing that I miss, but I certainly don't have any sleepless nights, mate. I have plenty of sleepless nights looking after little ones. The last thing I'm doing is thinking, oh, you know, I wish I was out there slugging out 10 by 400 or something like that.
Which brings us, well, sort of brings us on to our final greatest race, which is the greatest race you have watched. And that can either be in person or it can be on TV, something, a race that's really inspired you as a viewer.
Yeah, I think it's one of those you can, there's so many to choose from, aren't we? You know, it's whatever your sport is, isn't it? Picking out your favourite moments, it's maybe a sense of time. But I've tried to do this one again, as we talked about, like, defining points. And we talked about I made my breakthrough in 1999, you know, as a 15-year-old, to realise that this is where I want to be. I vividly remember the Sydney Olympics 800-metre final. I still think to this day, I think it's the most closely contested. So it was like 0.3 of a second between the first five. But also it was like, I was a huge Wilson Kipketer fan. So just see, you know, he was the modern day, well, so at that time, the Davy Rudisha, wasn't he? He made everything look so easy, but equally so, he was in another league, wasn't he? He was breaking the world record, you know, he breaks Sebco's world record, and he was always about 2 or 3 seconds ahead of everyone, wasn't he? So he was like, he was by far the standout. This is the late 90s sort of thing. Coming into 2000, he was still the favourite, but he wasn't as intimidating, I guess, to everyone. But as I'm just looking at the results now, as he went through the sort of lineup, as regards to, there was some great names as regards to Sai Girny, Sepeng, Boucher as well. You know, there's Bozakovsky, who loved the whole, you know, last until the last 100 metres and then come through incredibly well. And that was basically, you know, I'm sure this is no spoiler, but Neil Schumann, the German, won this. I think he's only over six. He was a good junior. He won the Europeans in 1998, but pretty much he was one of those where you'd expect him to make the final, but that was about it. But he was one of those, it went out slow. And I remember just talking about the race with my coach, and he always used to say, that's always an example of just give yourself a chance. There's so many, especially in distance running, everyone fancies the kick, or everyone likes the great run from behind. And especially when it's slow, what excuse is there for you to not be in the and I think Schumann, watching back the race prior to this interview, mate, he's never outside of the top five. He's always in there within a chance. Kipketer throws it away, basically, because they go through in 53. But that was one of those races where, you know, for a bit of an underdog like myself, that we are Mo Farah's contemporaries, aren't we? We're the same age, and obviously growing up with Mo, he was always like light years ahead, wasn't he, sort of thing. But those were one of the races that just reminded you that on the biggest stage possible, if you just give yourself a chance, believe in your fitness, execute a race plan. He did the perfect thing of, he was always on the inside line, so he's running the shortest way the whole way around, and then just come into that last home straight. And like I say, as you mentioned, just if there's only 0.3 of them separating the first five, because that's, you know, if it's a slow pace, there's only, all of them are pretty much running a fresh last 400 metres, where they're arguably, that's the leveler, isn't it, sort of thing. Whereas if Kipketer takes it out in 48, 49, there is only so many of them who can come, well, he was probably the only one who could come back with a 52, 53. whereas they go through him, they go through him 53 seconds. And Kipkit is not alone, you know. Booker was one of those where if he used to be a great front runner, if he would have taken it through in 51:50 or whatever. But again, I always look back on that race and just think, Neil Schumann. And I'm pretty sure he did nothing literally after that, which I have so much respect for, the fact that he was just like, you know, I've slogged my guts out. Yeah, I've won the Europeans. I think he was last in the world champs in 99 and he won the Olympics. And I'm sure there was arguably maybe injury, and it perhaps wasn't just a complete motivation leveler or anything like that. But he was just like, that's me done. What more do I need to do, sort of thing? Whereas we're all a bit like, because it's one of those, we can always run a bit quicker, can't we? And but when you win the biggest prize of all, and it's like, not being funny, I don't think he ever thought I got away with one or whatever. You know, he's one of those rare people who can just say, on that day, I was the best, you know, my personal best. I think he never ran quicker than 1:44 or whatever. But how many people, not so far away from the world record, but can say that, you know, this was my personal best, but I'm a gold medalist or whatever, you know. It's we don't get that many huge shocks, do we, in distance running? By and large, maybe the person doesn't win it or whatever, but whoever does step up, you can always argue a case of, well, they were a contender. That's one of my vivid memories growing up of someone who was like, obviously, yeah, finalist, but no one was backing him to, you know, other than the Germans, obviously, to say he's going to. Because he was so tall, mate, as well. He was like 6'5" or whatever, and you know, Sepeng was this little short guy who was knocking out 1:43s, 1:42s for fun or whatever. Kip Keter, and it was just like, you know, it was great.
Well, I bet towards the cops, he was licking his lips, wasn't he? I bet he was licking his lips.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. They're all sort of it's one of those. The commentator's cliche, you can throw a blanket over the whole field at the bell sort of thing. Everyone had a chance, but like I say, Schumann just gave himself the best. And I can't see myself ever going into coaching, and I don't want to be one of those pushy parents that says to my son, I'll get into running or whatever. But I'd always like to think, so many people just throw races away by wanting to come from behind or do it the cool way or whatever, but just if it's slow, just put yourself on the shoulder. Do you know what I mean? Just all, because you're always going to beat someone who's probably on paper better than you, purely by just saying, I'm brave enough to just be at the front and take this and just give myself an opportunity to win it.
Absolutely, a great choice. It's the first time I've had it. I think we've never had that.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. There's lots of other races. Yeah, there's lots of other races, mate, I could have gone into. But again, I've tried to think about that personal connection that you sort of, when you see those races and just think back and just like, that's one of the races I'll never forget. I'll never forget that race.
Fantastic. Well, I shouldn't keep you too much long because we've been at it for a while, but I should ask three quick fire questions to finish us off.
Go for it, mate.
And those are, if you could be anywhere running now, where would it be?
So I was very fortunate to go training once in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And for some reason, it was my only taste of altitude. I don't ever look back at it as what if sort of thing. But obviously, I just seem to respond really well from altitude. My whole, you know, the track interval sessions, I don't think I ever did any better interval sessions than I did out there. But equally so, basically, just the trails that they had up there, they're just either way. It's one of those where, unfortunately, I overtrained when I was there. I loved it that much that I was just like, I needed someone to put a leash on me. But I remember vividly just doing like a 20-mile run and just thinking, God, I could just run this. The scene, basically, because you go up such an elevation, you're just looking down on the city. There's runners all around you. I was fortunate to train with the New Mexico University team at the time. And I just always think that it just felt so easy, mate. I was never one of those that looked at splits. But I had to feel it. I responded that well that I was looking at what I was going out for easy runs and running like 6-minute miling. And so I was like, I never ran this quick in my life sort of thing. And it just felt effortless. So again, you know, little bit of the whole, if I could go back and have that feeling now to just think that I'm out here, the air's a bit thinner and I can just run for miles upon miles. That's definitely somewhere where I would head right now.
Fantastic. Second question is, recommend us something. So it can be pretty broad remit, so from a book, film, an experience, basically anything you want to recommend our listeners to give a try to, then here's your opportunity.
Yeah, so I definitely tapped into the whole, you know, or again, us endurance people, we could list off a lot of similar books, I'd imagine, you know, Running with the Buffalo, Sub 4, or there's so many, you know, autobiographies. But Gold in the Water, so as the title suggests, it's basically about swimming. But I always feel as though, particularly, you know, runners, we always think we've got this monopoly on pain, don't we, that no one else... We know other people do endurance sports, don't we? You know, cycling, swimming, etc. But we're the ones who really suffer the most. We slog it out the most. But, like, honestly, read this. It's basically about someone's journey. I'm pretty sure, was it the Sydney? It's basically about qualification for the Olympic Games. And I've always been obsessed with this whole American culture of, I think, certainly in Britain, don't we? It's like, oh, one or two people will get the standard. And when they used to have B standards, you know, they might take someone on a B standard and stuff like that. But across the board, pretty much in America, is like, because obviously it's such a huge country, that final for whatever it is, if it's track, if it's, you know, cycling, if it's in the pool or whatever, literally it's that first three and there's no revisiting or whatever. You get it right on the day and you're off to the biggest prize of all. And it's basically, I don't want to give any spoilers away, but basically it's about a swimmer's journey and that pursuit of Olympic gold, you know. And again, it's one of those where pretty much pull that out once a year or something during my, you know, my most competitive days. And just, there's so many things that, you know, just someone just putting themselves on the line, just living, sleeping and breathing, being a better athlete, and just that whole different world of swimming. It, I just really enjoyed it. It was recommended to me by another runner, and I definitely would, if anyone wants, who's maybe getting a little bit stale of the whole, you know, the whole running sacrifice and stuff like that, just another take on it. Definitely check that out. Gold in the Water.
Fantastic. And the final one, I guess we haven't really answered this one, but what's, in your opinion, is the greatest endurance performance of all time?
Yeah, I had another thought about this, basically, mate. Sonia O'Sullivan did the double at the World Cross in 1998. Again, you can, physiologically, I'm sure, I've not taken anything from Sonia, you know, we talk about, we're obviously going sub 2 hours in a men's marathon these days, so I'm sure someone can argue a case physiologically, but, and this was in, it wasn't, Bikili came after that, but he commonly did the double, didn't he? But it was always, the short course for the men was always on the, like, World Cross used to be over a weekend, short course for the men on the first day, long race for the women on the first day, and then they'd swap over. And I always think, if you're going to try and contemplate that double, you'd much prefer to do the short race the first day and then, you know, the long race the next day, which obviously what Bikili often did so well. But she did it the other way around, you know. She won the long race and then came back the next day to take on some of the best, you know. That short, what you loved about the short course race was you'd have the best 1,500 3K runners. And she just absolutely destroyed them. Remember, I used to love the Nike Jasari spikes as well, and she ran cross country in Jasari spikes. It was in Marrakesh as well, so there's no, you know, the Africans didn't have any excuses as regards to it was a muddy bog or whatever or anything like that. It was prime for an African domination. And, you know, credit to Sonia O'Sullivan, who's always been, and that's another great book if anyone wants to read Sonia O'Sullivan's autobiography. But she was just, I don't know if that was a very peak. I think obviously she came second in Sydney, didn't she, behind Szabo. But that, for me, the whole thought of the mental strength of being able to run a tough, I'm pretty sure it would have been an 8K race on day one against the best in the world, and come back with less than half a day rest or whatever, take the best short endurance runners on and come away with two gold medals is just incredible, mate. So that's definitely, again, something that really resonates with me.
Perfect. Well, thanks a lot for chatting, Tom. I hopefully football will be back soon, and you'll get back out there and get a bit more commentary going.
Yeah, well, that's the plan, mate. Hopefully I can maybe do a few more runs as well, just to make myself feel a little bit more better as well.
Yeah, you'll be out there tomorrow, so I'm trying to recreate those that feeling of that 3:48. It'll be
To this day, I'm one of those. It's a bit sad, isn't it? I always during my time as a, you know, as a, what I'd consider an athlete, I'd always think, right, this is the last 100 metres of the 3As or something like that. I've even found myself doing that this week, mate. You know what I mean? I'm just like, I'm that unfit. I'm having to take myself to a place where I'm thinking, this, you know, just to complete a 15, 20 minute run, just toughing out those last things, thinking, oh, I'm here, I'm neck and neck with
whoever, and this is the Olympic final, just dig in, Gale, dig in, Gale. So that's never going to die, mate. I'm still going to fascinate
and try and imagine that that's a real life scenario. But thanks for having me on, mate. Thank you.
Great to chat. Cheers, Dom.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.